out among the outlaws, he said, "Come, follow me." People from all walks of life since have been becoming outlaws.
Welcome. Often when we think of the early church, the very first Christians, it's hard not to imagine them without the halos over their heads, maybe even angelic music just following them around. And they float through life in a godly, spiritual aura, spreading the good news and living as blameless, sinless saints on earth. At least that's the image that art and religious depictions have presented us throughout the ages. We seem to have a collective belief that the early church was nearly perfect, and it's been in a state of gradual decline ever since, leading to this, cesspool we now find ourselves in. It's always great to learn from the past. Of course, history is the greatest teacher. However, we tend to romanticize the past. There's a great book out that delves into this topic, and it reveals that no matter the time period, the church has been made up of, surprisingly, people like you and me, flawed. And each generation has allowed, to one degree or another, their behaviors and their worship and their Christian faith to be influenced by their contemporary culture. Dr. Nadia Williams holds a PhD in classics and program in the ancient world from Princeton University and is a military historian of the Greco-Roman world. Her most recent book is Cultural Christians in the Early Church, a historical and practical introduction to Christians in the Greco-Roman world. And what adds a little extra layer of interest to me is Dr. Williams defines herself as being growing up a cultural Jew or in a secular Jewish household, first in the Soviet Union, later in Israel. And what does that mean, cultural Jew versus Jewish or secular Jew? And of course, what does it mean to be a cultural Christian? And are you one? Am I one? Dr. Williams, please help us out and welcome.
Well, thank you for having me here.
Oh, I love this topic. I've never discussed it here before, but the term cultural Christian, I guess I've used it a lot. I hear it around. How would you define that?
Well, it's a good question. And with definitions, of course, we want to make sure the readers or listeners are on the same page. So when I think of cultural Christians, I think the people who go to church most Sundays, but then the rest of the week, you might compartmentalize your faith. You know, you go to work, you raise your children, you fight with your spouse, maybe. You just do all the things that you would typically do because, you know, this is America. There are so many things available and you just kind of assume like this is just life, especially like middle class American life. There are certain things you do and you just do all of them and you don't think about like, what would the Bible say about this? And so that's where you become a cultural Christian. If anybody asked you, like say on one of those like Gallup polls or something, like, what are you? You would say like, well, of course I'm a Christian or I'm an evangelical. If somebody were to start digging in, like, well, what standards do you use for making decisions for any aspect of your life? Then it would suddenly emerge that, well, it's actually the culture.
Yeah. When I think of it, I think of it in terms of, it would seem like it's natural that every generation would worship or reflect their Christianity within the bounds of the culture around them, and nothing wrong with that. That's just, we don't have to go back and try to live and behave exactly like people did 2,000 years ago. It wouldn't make sense. But as far as following the faith and the beliefs, I see it as, to go right to scripture with it, as the horrifying example of Jesus turning away people who thought they were Christian, who thought they were following him because they attended church or they did the cultural, quote, Christian things, but actually weren't Christian. Is that what we're talking about? Or are we talking about just kind of how we do Christianity?
I think it's a little bit of both, and it's difficult to distinguish. The thing with cultural Christianity, what I'm trying to get at is, you can't even tell a lot of times. You just live your life. And the same thing with the Christians who follow Jesus. So like, for example, the chapter on finances, I talk about Ananias and Sapphira as kind of the first cultural Christians. So here are people who are thinking like, I really love the church. I want to support the local church. I'm going to give them money. But also like they're thinking, well, how do we do this in a way that fits in our picture of Greco-Roman attitudes to benefaction? Well, if I'm giving money to the church, they better like recognize me or something. I want to get some praise for it. And that's very much a cultural attitude that seeps into it. So we see them falling into sin, perhaps because they were thinking more about things of the world rather than thinking, well, what is Jesus telling us to do when it comes to our finances? So you see kind of that, like they want to follow Christ, but they also want to follow the world.
Yeah. Did the early church fall into, so I think of the widest view of cultural Christianity currently would be, what religion are you? Well, I'm a Westerner, so I'm Christian. You kind of put yourself under this general umbrella of your nationalism becomes your religion sort of thing. Then you narrow it down to, I'm a Christian, I attend, and I do the right things that Christians do. And then you get down to Jesus teaching, not so much about rules, but that you must be born again. You have to have a conversion, or you're living a cultural Christian life, no matter what era. Am I looking at that correctly?
I think so. So we're getting into kind of the, it's really difficult, you know, for historians, because we're trying to look at hearts. Like, what is your motivation? And that's really difficult.
Yeah.
And yet we see those hints of that. Like, again, with Ananias and Sapphira, we see hearts that are moved more by culture than by Christ's calling on their lives. But it is difficult. And it leads to, again, that question of motive. Sometimes cultural Christians are rebelling in a way that's a little bit more discernible. And sometimes it's more accidental. That's where culture is so dangerous, because we live in it. Like, it's hard to tell it apart. What aspects do we think of something that we're doing? Do we think, oh, that's the gospel? And then you realize, like, well, actually, it's not.
Yeah. A verse that comes to mind is, make your calling and election sure. And I think about, if you put it in the context of this, if it can be, it would be like, reflect on yourself. And am I living a Christian cultural life? Or have I connected with God in the real and experienced the real faith? Like, make sure. So I'd like to hear some of the stories of the early church, but I'd like to dive in a little bit real quick into your background. So in general, in conversation, if a Jewish conversation comes up, or a Jewish race or this and that, and if I explain to people that, or I'll get asked a lot, how in the world are there Jewish Christians? That doesn't make sense to me. But the answer goes back to, well, there's cultural Jews, and then there's those who have come to faith in Christ, that you're born into a kind of a segment or a race of people, but that's not necessarily your faith. But in our minds, we've combined the two, haven't we?
Yeah, although persecutions of Jews, over the centuries have really emphasized the ethnic part, it seems like, perhaps more than religion. So in that regard, it kind of makes sense, like the ethnicity, I am a Jew, but my faith is I'm a Christian.
Right, which to me, or a Christian point of view, would be that isn't separate, because we would say this is the Jewish Messiah. But So explain a little bit about your background there. Like, what was your family like growing up? So not to be a cultural Jewish person, or what's called a secular Jew, is basically you're born Jewish, right? But you're not Orthodox in that you're practicing or attending synagogue and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And I was born in the Soviet Union, where religion was technically illegal. So no one attended synagogue or church or anything. Mm-hmm. I guess some people did underground. I didn't know any of them. In fact, I didn't even know that I was Jewish until about a year before we started the process of applying to immigrate out of the Soviet Union to Israel. And that's when I learned that my mother was Jewish and kind of there's this whole baggage to go with it. And so in 1991, right before the Soviet Union collapsed, my family moved to Israel. And that's where it was kind of like, oh, okay. And that's where, like in retrospect, most of the kids I knew were cultural Jews. For all of us, Israel was important. So many, I mean, like, for example, one kid in my elementary, or I think it was seventh grade class, actually, his grandfather had been on Schindler's List, like that sort of thing, where you'd sort of like, okay, that hits home. You know, the Holocaust is only a little bit removed. My own grandmother lost most of her family. I know less about my grandfather's story, but I know he lost a lot of relatives too. So it's one of those things where you realize like that's what brings everybody together, that you've lost relatives. Like people have actual names and of people that they've heard about but will never meet because, well, like they're gone. And Israel was founded on all of this, like baggage, the trauma, generational trauma that combined to just kind of haunt everybody in a way. But religion wasn't really a part of it, at least not in my school. I know there were plenty of observant Jews around, but I just didn't know any. I was in a circle, like in a typical public school with other kids like me.
Yeah. So I love your background and in this topic because you can study something. But if you were born and raised, let's say, an evangelical Christian home in the West, you're still kind of in a bubble, no matter how educated you get. Like I realize I'm in a mental bubble. I have to try to think out of it. But it's nice to have a perspective where you're coming into, let's say, a Western world and actually an opposing faith than what you were born in. And then to be able to look at what cultural Christianity is. Because when you're in it, you don't know it. But it seems like you could spot it easier, at least in our contemporary culture. I don't know if that's true or not. But give us some examples. Start back. You started already. But in the early church, where do we see it? And I mean, we see it in what Paul was addressing initially, right?
Absolutely.
And so what was going on kind of culturally that he would have to say these seemingly obvious things to us today?
Well, and the fact that they're seemingly obvious to us today should give us pause because, like, what are our blind spots, right? So blind spots are always much easier to see in hindsight. So historians
One of my favorite memes out right now is that if Paul was here, we'd all be getting a letter.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's true. Yeah. Well, so, I mean, even the Corinthians, like that's so many blind spots there that we see. The entire First Corinthians letter is basically that list of cultural sins, like food, how they treat banqueting with each other. The idea that some people go hungry and others get full. Well, that's a Roman banquet right there. In a typical Roman banquet, the whole idea is the food that you serve and how much of it you serve to people reflects their status. So if you're poor, who cares if you didn't get anything? Because the Roman Empire doesn't care about you. That's very much a Roman cultural attitude. And Paul is reminding them, like, well, this is not how we are. Like, in Christ, we're all beloved sons and daughters. This doesn't work like that. Or the idea of frequenting prostitutes, which he also calls out. And again, that would have been a respectable sin of sorts in the Roman world. Like everybody did it. So, and it's just a list of warnings of the things that like everybody is doing it. Well, that doesn't mean that it's okay for you as a Christian. But here you are living in a city that's very much a metropolitan city filled with all of the opportunities that are available to people living in that culture.
Yeah. One thing I found really interesting in your book was that I had never considered. You know, I've always been interested in the martyrs and the martyr stories because they're so inspiring that people, you know, all they have to say is Caesar is Lord and they won't. And they're executed or fed to lions or burned alive. And all that is still inspiring. And however, there ended up being kind of a dark side to that, didn't it, culturally, that it became the in thing to do or the height of spirituality.
Yes. So one of my favorite stories that I tell in the book is Cyprian, Bishop of Carthage, in the height of the pandemic in the mid third century, he delivers this sermon on the plague to his congregation. And it's sort of like a list of frequently asked questions. And one of the questions that he noted getting from the congregation is people who are saying, it's like, could I please not take care of these like sick and dying people? I don't want to get sick because I'm saving myself for martyrdom. And it's one of those moments where it's like, wait, what just happened?
Yes. And that's not a one-off, right? I mean, people,
it's not a one-off. Like, no.
It became a thing for attention. I mean, this is a terrible example, but like it was almost the Christian Instagram of the day, like the selfies and attention seeking or worse is, it reminded me a little bit while I was reading it, except it wasn't harming others, but almost the terrorist point of view of honor in your death. And I thought, I never really looked, I mean, there is in a Christian martyr for the faith, but it was self-glorification to be remembered and seen as this, and it'll bring honor to my name. And we can make anything a sin, can't we?
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is. We can take something good like martyrdom, which was meant to be like a good thing. You're glorifying God, and then make it about yourself, in which case it actually becomes very Homeric, typical Greco-Roman cultural kind of idea of honor. I'm going to have a name that never dies because of this like really glorious death that I chose for myself. You could die this glorious death on the battlefield, or you could die this glorious death as a martyr, but it really adds up to that same kind of thing. So it is yet another example of culture, like that deeply, like the thing that soaks into your pores, like you can't even tell that you're just inspired by the culture in everything that you do. But there it is in those kinds of attitudes.
Okay, what else as far as, I also found interesting, I forget what you call them, but the people that kind of made their way out into the desert to live the isolated life for Christ in the faith. What was that about?
Yeah, I had a lot of fun reading their stories. It's one of those where it's easy to make fun of them. It's these people who said, you know what, being around people, so all these sinful people who fill churches, right? They're distracting me from God. I'm going to check out, quit church. While I'm at it, I'm going to quit society, go into the desert, live on like 3 figs a week and maybe half a cup of water, and just worship God, like focus on nothing but God for the next 40 years or however long the desert takes to kill me. And what's fascinating is that they become tourist attractions, some of them anyway, like Antony. But in the process, what is really intriguing is that we see patterns of sin continue to emerge. So the sayings of the desert fathers and desert mothers that survive show their struggles with sin, where one of them says, I've been alone for 20 years and I'm still I'm still struggling with an anger issue. It's like, really? Right. Or Antony, who was fighting demons while alone for 20 years. And you realize those demons are actually personal sins. So no matter what you do, you bring them with you. And it's a reminder for us, because so many people today, I was thinking of this parallel as I was writing about the desert saints. So many people say, like, the church is not behaving well. And I've heard a lot of those comments, especially in light of the Southern Baptist Convention scandals. I'm quitting church. I'm going to love Jesus on my own. And my point is, well, people have been trying to do that since the early church, and it doesn't work so well. The point is that you need community. That doesn't mean you have to stay in a church that is harmful, but you do need community of other Christians, other sinners. This idea of like, I need to find that perfect church that does things exactly the way I would like it to do. Thanks so much. I don't want to get locked in. I mean, that's such a modern American thing to say, you know?
Yeah.
We want things the way we want them, but it's not about us. And that's where the gospel has so many reminders for us. Like, you should be serving. I love the qualifications for elders, for instance, the listing. Like, why does an elder have to be, you know, a husband and a father? Because nobody locks you down more like a family where, right. you know, there's no sanctification like staying up all night with a baby who is throwing up or things like that. You have real people calling you to community and you can't quit. And it doesn't look like your ideal, but that's the point. And church should be doing these things. I mean, again, like there certainly are situations where it becomes abusive, but my point is if we have those kinds of the standards more like the self-sacrifice that Christ calls us to, when we think of that more in terms of what church should be, it becomes a much more beautiful thing. And it's not about us. It really isn't.
What was most surprising for you? Item or two while you were looking at this topic? And did you start with this topic or did it kind of morph while you were doing your homework? You know, because I interview a lot of authors, and there seems to be a difference between when I study like, or when I interview people who've done academic studies versus more of a broader topic, Christian topic. They know what they're going into in the broader and they write about it and they publish it. I kind of find a trend that when it's an academic study, that it seems to vary from how it started because of the study always takes you in a different direction. Do you find that the
case? Yeah, absolutely. So when I first started, I was thinking like the idea that I had in mind, what I was noticing is early churches were filled with sinners. And that was kind of my starting point when I was first like gathering material. And so this was going to be a book about sinners in the early church and like the leaders who loved them well, called them into repentance, and all of that. But then as I was getting more into the story, I realized that the common thread to the sins that I was looking at was culture. And that's where everything kind of clicked into place. And I realized also that the story was going to be larger in scope, because originally I was thinking I was going to focus more on like the third, fourth, fifth centuries. But then when I realized I was looking at cultural Christians, it made more sense to start the story at the very beginning, because they were there from the very beginning. So yeah, these stories definitely kind of click together as I was working. But in a way, it was also pushing me to think like, why tell stories like this, right? Because it almost feels like historical gossip. Like, here are really awful things people were doing. Let me tell you some more. We really love talking about negative things, right? If you look at the news, the positive stuff rarely makes the news. I mean, occasionally you might get a feel-good story, like somebody rescued a cat. Great. But most of the time, we really like the really awful stuff in the news. It really skews, the balance skews that way. And especially when it comes to church, it's the scandals that always make the news. I mean, there are the vast majority of Christians, even today, who are really wonderful people who love their neighbor, love their family, and so on. Does this make the news? No. So writing a book like this about sinners, I was worried that I would be getting into that trap also of like, here's all the dirty laundry that I can tell you. And I wanted this to be encouraging. And the question is like, how do you make it encouraging? And my point was like, let's bring it to ourselves. Like, who are we? In what ways are we, do we need to be convicted today?
Yeah. I mean, it is kind of a fun read in kind of reading their dirty laundry, but not because it's, you know, gossipy, more because it's it makes you feel not justified in like how bad my behavior is, but that just that we're all human and it's all a struggle. These people were not very far out from when Christ actually lived, or the apostles, and some of them were still living with the apostles, and they're doing crazy stuff. And that's always been a good example for us, you know. Paul saying, "I'm the worst of sinners," and that him confessing that I still struggle and I always do what I don't want to do. But if they left it as just the halo image We tend to go that way, but yet even those people are trying to say it's a struggle. And I think your book lays that out in a balanced way. But tell us about the early, I don't want to call them nuns because nuns didn't exist yet.
Yes.
But about these women, you know who I'm talking about.
Yes. So it's, again, Cyprian of Carthage, who gets a lot of mileage in my book. He was a really gentle pastor. I feel like, a lot of early church leaders, you read their work, even Paul, and you think, I don't know if I want to be in a church that this person pastored. It might have been a little too intense. But Cyprian strikes me as somebody who would have been a really kind, loving pastor, like the kind of person you would grab a cup of coffee with and have a good conversation. And he would just listen and like hit you with the gospel, but in a way that would be like so gentle and kind. So one problem that he ran into a lot of problems, but one problem he ran into, and he wrote a treatise about it, involved consecrated virgins. So women who had consecrated themselves to Christ, they're unmarried. Their job, if you want to call it that, is to pray for the church. But here they are living in a cosmopolitan Roman city yet again. So surprise, the culture around is kind of affecting them. And in particular, in Carthage at the time, it was fashionable to go to public baths where you could bathe openly in the nude. And this is mixed bathing. And so Cyprian is trying to explain, like, this is just not a good idea. But also these women are very much interested in fancy clothing, fancy jewelry. And he's trying to kind of gently tell them, these are not things that are appropriate for you as consecrated to Christ. When God looks at you, he looks at you as beloved daughters, and that's what should matter. So I found his discussion of these issues really kind and compassionate, trying to remind them that the culture should not have them in its grasp, because in Greco-Roman culture, the way you looked reflects your status. So for these women, there was, again, the allure of culture, like, well, if I'm from a wealthy background, of course I should be maximizing jewelry whenever I'm out in public. And Cyprian is trying to say, like, no, this is not about it. Yeah. But I found that conversation also fascinating in light of the occasional, it keeps rotating through social media periodically, conversations about why women should or should not wear yoga pants or leggings or something like that. And so I thought of Cyprian in that light also, where the rebukes there that he gives to these women are not that they're seducing others. The rebukes that he gives them about their clothing, appearance, or public nude bathing have to do with their own souls. And that is so beautiful. Like, it's about your relationship with God. It's not about what anybody else thinks about you.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned yoga pants. I didn't think about that, but in my little opening comments, just talking about, that we think we're on a decline morally and that the early church was so perfect. You're talking about, like, in modern day, you know, it looks like women at the gym almost don't have clothes on because of yoga pants. But then you're talking about these nun-like women consecrated to Christ back then that were okay being completely naked in public and didn't see harm in it because of their culture. Not making it right or wrong, but culture is culture, and it's always influenced us.
Exactly. That's what it is. And it's all a matter of what you look at. So if we come to the evidence with a preconceived notion of these Christians were all so much better than us, we'll find it. We'll look at the martyrs and overlook everybody else. And if we want to write a story about the decline, we can certainly find enough evidence to do it. But as historians, I certainly want us to look at kind of the full gamut of picture, the full picture that we can see, the full gamut of evidence that we have available. And the evidence is more complicated because people are complicated.
Yeah. Another issue you addressed I thought was interesting and brave is a Christian nationalism. And it's funny because, you know, sometimes you say, well, when I was younger, I thought of it this way. Now, well, that's your culture, right? The culture you were raised in, the environment you had, that was your frame of mind. And I never once thought specifically or said, you know, like America is, God's country, basically, this or that. But as I got older, I started to reflect and I think, you know, I think some people do. And there's a difference between God blessing a country, which he can bless every country that puts him first. So would nationalism or Christian nationalism be, no, it's my country? Or just to define that for me.
So I look at Christian nationalism through the eyes of Augustine, or, you know, to the extent that anybody can look through anything through the eyes of Augustine. But so to give the background, in 410 AD, the city of Rome was sacked by the Goths. And it was the first time that Rome had been sacked in centuries. And for everybody who was alive in the Roman Empire at the time, this was the most traumatic event of their lives. Like, how could God allow this to happen to Rome is what every Christian was asking. Every pagan was asking, how could the Christians have allowed this to happen to Rome by, you know, making the pagan gods unhappy? Anyway, so Augustine wrote his City of God as a response to these concerns from both the Christians and the pagans. And in the process, he reflects, you know, the entirety of Christian existence up until that moment had been under the umbrella of the Roman Empire. So, of course, like, it's really easy to conflate God and country, where the only country where you've known this faith to exist has been that one. So the Roman Empire for Christians was like, of course, like, the two exist together. One makes the other possible. And you almost forget, like, which one did what. And Augustine is trying to call people to repentance in the process, and seems to be preaching very much to himself as well. Like, yes, this is awful, but God is with us. But also, if you look at previous history of Rome, Augustine says, God has always been with Rome. God has always made sure that the rain fell on just and the unjust, and God is in charge of history. So an accurate view of the past and an accurate view of the future is crucial for Christians to kind of go through suffering in this life. And it is suffering. I mean, he says, like, to see your country not doing well is suffering.
Yeah. Yeah. God's kingdom ultimately is without borders, right?
Exactly. Well, and ultimately God's kingdom is not here. And that's what Augustine's point is. The city of God, it's not here. But it will come.
Right. What would you say? Well, actually, before we go on, I'm interested with the guy on the pillar. What was that all about?
Simeon Stylites. He is a gift to historians of the early church. So this is a guy who, I mean, we talked a little bit earlier about quitters, people who quit church, you know, quit society, moved into the desert. He kind of wanted to do that, but he, instead of going into the desert, he decided, you know what? I'm just going to move higher and higher. Like, he moves to an abandoned town and starts out on a pillar that's a few feet above the ground and thinks, like, I'm just going to have this be my desert. I'm going to be alone. Nobody's going to bother me. Well, he becomes instead a public attraction, and people keep coming to him, and he keeps moving to higher and higher pillars. Finally, he settles on one that was 50 feet off the ground, and he lives there for the remaining, like, 30 odd years of his life. Society to live alone. Instead, there are Byzantine emperors coming to see him. Anybody famous, but also just anybody else would come to see him pray, sit in silence. And on occasion, he taught, too, all from a pillar.
Interesting life.
Very uncomfortable life. We hear he was kind of malformed after a while. I mean, as you might imagine, when you're, like, on a tiny little pillar and you're trying to sleep there and all that. But I guess he eventually came to terms with the fact that he couldn't escape people. I guess eventually he dies mid-prayer.
So you've kind of summarized it anyway, but overall, what would you want people to get from this book, or who haven't read it yet? What's the main thing that we could walk away with and, you know, that Christians would contemplate to make it relevant in their head today, other than, you know, historical, not gossip, but historical information about the early church?
I could summarize it as, like, good news, bad news. So the good news is you're a lot more like the early church if you're a Christian today. The bad news is you're a lot more like the early church than you ever imagined if you're a Christian today. But that history makes it relevant. Like, their stories are our stories.
Yeah, very good. All right, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Gathered among the outlaws, he said, "Come, follow me." People from all walks of life since have been becoming outlaws.